Hello, busybodies. Welcome to another episode of The Busyness Paradox. I'm Frank Butler, here with Paul Harvey. Paul Harvey?
Not doing it, Frank. Not going to say it.
No?
I'm on strike.
Dang.
All right, fine. Good day.
I guess we'll have to agree to give you an extra day of vacation then. Unpaid time off.
Unpaid, of course. Right. That's all I ask.
Unpaid time off. So as you guys probably know that we're opening this episode discussing the railroad strike, which was all the rage when this was recorded. And we really wanted to bring this up because it's going to lead into a broader thing going on across the board that impacts a lot of people. And this railroad strike certainly could have impacted a lot more people.
Yeah, this could have been a mess.
Yeah, it could have been a mess. But first and foremost, if you're not familiar with the railroad strike in the United States, we had a big lead up to the railroad workers potentially striking. And one of the reasons that they were considering striking was just being able to see a doctor or go to a healthcare appointment without repercussions. They didn't even have time off for that.
Or anything else.
It's terrible. But one of the concessions they made was to give them an unpaid day off to go see a doctor, which to me is just like, there were repercussions to this whole thing? Like, really?
Your job, the way it's currently structured, my understanding, is it's basically you and one other person driving a 5-mile-long train across the country and don't get time off to see a doctor if you're sick. Do you want a sick person driving 500 million tons of steel down a train track? How do we get to this point?
Well, and let's put this in a little bit of context, right? In 2000, Union Pacific, one of the rail companies, employed 50,000 people and it generated about $11.8 billion in revenues. Today, it has 18,000 fewer employees, so about 32,000, but earns 85% more revenue each year. And they say that shifts can last up to 80 hours a week already. This year, Buffett's BNSF, owned by Berkshire Hathaway, they earned an operating margin, their best operating margin in at least 21 years, while the percent of revenue spent on labor is at its lowest. So they've increased or they've had their best profit margins, and now they're looking at having a smaller and smaller percentage of revenue spent, and they're continuing to squeeze their workers. And they had introduced a point-based attendance system, which resulted in workers getting just one day off each month. Meanwhile, since 2010, the four primary rail companies have delivered about $124 billion to shareholders in dividends and stock repurchases. Now, keep in mind, that's a little over $10 billion a year. Well, we talk about giving somebody a day off unpaid to go see a doctor.
$10 billion to goose your stock price, but not what does it cost to give someone a day off to go see a doctor? Or do anything else, like to be just not working for a day.
It hurts my soul. I mean, it's just humanity, right? Just thinking humanity.
I think the biggest disgrace, or second biggest disgrace about this, is that a lot of us are just now hearing about this. This has been going on in its current state for 2 years now, and we've heard nothing from the media, from the government. It's been just kind of brushed aside that there might be a little bit of labor troubles. And what we have heard, at least in my experience, has been, and again, this is not just by like political interest, but just the news media in general, of kind of trying to lump them together with some of the more, some of the less defensible teachers unions during the pandemic, trying to like lump them together with teachers unions that didn't want to reopen the schools. This is so night and day.
Yeah.
Neither of us are, historically like super pro union or anything, but I mean, this is completely irrelevant that there even is a union involved here. I mean, this is just
basic human needs for
inhuman way of treating people. And it's freaking dangerous, man. Guys are driving trains.
It blows my mind. And just thinking about it, even as we've said in the show in the past, companies get the unions they deserve.
Yeah.
And in this context, it's even worse than that, because they probably deserve a union that's maybe more on the absurd side as some unions have been.
They need one of those like 70s corrupt auto plant unions, man.
they start breaking the kneecaps of the CEOs. Be like, if you don't give our guys this, yeah. I still don't think we figured out where Jimmy Hoffa is buried. But
no.
you know, thinking about that whole process though, I mean, in my mind, just looking at just a basic thing like being able to go to a doctor and just getting time off for that. And they don't have sick leave. There's no sick leave. And the craziest part about this is that their contract is going to be up for renegotiation for, I think it's 2024, 2025, because this actually is regarding a contract that was supposed to have been taken care of, I think, in 2020.
So that's 2 years this has been going on. Yeah.
The nice thing about their pay raise that they're getting in there, which is a 24% pay raise over 5 years, starts backwards. So it's going to kick in that 2020 and go out to the end of this contract. So there's still a chance within 2 years we might see another strike going on.
It seems to happen way more than it should. You have these protracted labor disputes and everything. Finally get a contract and it's retroactive 3 years and it's got like 9 months left in it. And then we're just going to be doing this again. Come on. But credit to the, you know, to the workers themselves on this. My understanding is that the government and the union officials many times in the past have come to agreements that are fairly one-sided in favor of the companies themselves, and with the expectation that the rank and file union members will just approve it. And this time they said, no, we're not. Whatever deal they cooked up with the President Biden's, what's it, presidential council, or I don't remember what it was called, but basically a task force to like work out this labor dispute. Whatever the deal was that they cooked up a couple of years ago, presented to the workers from the union bosses, and the workers said, no, we're done with this nonsense. So good for them.
Yeah, and that's because now Biden's gotten his people involved, right? The Department of...
Again, but he was there 2 years ago with whatever deal that they rejected too.
Was that
not him personally, but his appointed council that worked with the union leadership. You know, they cooked up some more of the same basic deal.
Oh, yeah.
Tried to cram it down the workers' throats.
I think this time they actually did a little bit more than...
I should hope so.
a little bit better. This deal at least sounds a lot sweeter. I think with the whole pandemic having been a situation too, I think obviously that's had its own impact. But these strikes are obviously, they happen everywhere, right? I mean, this is the thing that it seems like there's just more and more strikes. But before we move into some other examples of that, I do want to just give a shout out to one of the guests we've had on in the past, Dr. Bento Lobo, who in our Frank and Paul Get Schooled episode talked about finance and sort of the role of finance. And he was interviewed with News Channel 9 here in Chattanooga. And he said, it causes all kinds of ripple effects through the economy. There's going to be shortages of food, industrial products, construction materials. Oftentimes that will drive up the prices of these things.
Well, that's the thing. We've had these shortages the past couple of years, so we had no idea. I don't think a lot of people, myself included, fully grasp the volume of stuff that is transported by rail. That, like, if that stopped, I can't even imagine, like, the empty stores and the, it would be like nothing that we've seen in any of these shortages we've had since the pandemic started.
I was going to say, I would think it's almost like what I saw at Walmart for a few times when I was over there, like bread aisle being empty for a while, or the chip aisle being completely empty, you know, just those kinds of things, toilet paper being gone for a while.
Like early 90s Romania, like nothing.
Nothing. And so that's the thing. And while we're going to get into how that would actually probably have a ripple effect through the economy, we did want to bring some light to some other strikes that are going on out there, or that had been going on, or that were threatening. Interestingly enough, there's been a lot of rail strikes around the world, right? I mean, there's been...
It's a commonly striking industry, it seems.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever been to Europe where at least one country wasn't having a rail strike at that time.
France is like the one.
England.
Time. Trains paralyzed again in UK as union stages more strikes. That was just recently. That's in the UK, United Kingdom, so Great Britain. They were having that. It actually even delayed the Premier League soccer from starting out, or football for that part of the world. Dutch rail strikes halt trains to and from Amsterdam and in the Netherlands. So you can see that. Oh, garbage piles in Scotland raise health concerns amid strikes. Mm. So they're having garbage being building up on the streets, and that smells great. In the US, we have... what, tons of school strikes that happened before school started. We have the Lufthansa pilots striking just recently, but that deal, or they were about to strike, and the Lufthansa management agreed to their concessions there. We had nurses in Minnesota and so on. What, you had Kaiser Permanente, right?
Kaiser Permanente out west, John Deere, it's got about 10,000. If you really want a rabbit hole to dive down, though, look up the Alabama coal miner strike. That's been going on since, I want to say, April 21.
Wow.
And it has been brutal. There's allegations. Well, the company sued the union for damages because of the strike. You know, a judge found in their favor for like $13 million and the miners are like, we're not paying that. What do you like? That's the point of a strike, is to cause economic damage.
Exactly.
There's been some, like, I don't remember all the details, but explosions. Things have been like blown up, gas line or something, some other stuff. And the company is saying that the striking workers did it. And the striking workers are saying, no, we have evidence that the company did it. And they're, you know, trying to frame us for it, basically. Whew. I mean, it is wild. Much like the railroad strike, we never hear anything about it. But yeah, that's a fun rabbit hole to go down.
That's so fascinating. And it's really interesting that we're seeing so much of this going on. And of course, there's a lot of reasons for it, for sure. I think there's a lot of people who felt mistreated during the pandemic. Or you look at the rail strike. I mean, if you look at these people, they've been forced more and more. I mean, even the comment in one of the articles, a train engineer right here, he said, the railroad wants to control 90% of my life. When I can work, when I'm free not to work, and so on. 90%. I mean,
and that's like true. If you do the math, like the hours it works out, like they got like 10 hours between shifts when they're mostly on call anyway. Common thread of a lot of these people striking is that they were told during the pandemic, you have to go to work and risk your health because you're an essential worker. You're so essential. Here's your crappy paycheck and nothing else.
No time off. And
doesn't balance out. Like, wait a minute, I'm so important. I have to go to work every day, risk my health, but I'm so insignificant that you don't need to pay me anything. Like, how does this happen?
And it's interesting because this goes back to something we had discussed at some previous time on the podcast, whether or not it's an episode we had published or not yet. I don't recall, but I do remember saying that it's something like at General Motors, 4% of their costs are really associated with people. Mm. And if you just saw, like, for example, with the Berkshire Hathaway subsidiary, their rail subsidiary, that was the smallest percentage of their revenues was their employment.
The smallest expense, you mean, is their employees.
Yeah, the smallest. Yeah.
And they're another one that went from like 50,000 to like 14,000 or something in the span of a decade. Yeah, employees.
There's a thing as being too lean. Yep. And what happens is people are picking up more and more responsibilities. They're having to work these longer hours and it's not okay.
Right.
It's squeezing it too far for what?
For what?
Right. You returned $124 billion to shareholders. Right. You've exploited your people. And that, I think, will cause more damage in the long run, and not just to your company, but obviously in this case, it could have had a significant disruption to our society in the United States as we know it.
And this, I think it's important not to fall into the trap of saying, well, evil management. The people making these decisions are regular people that are working in a system that incentivizes what they're doing. So every quarter, every fiscal year, whatever, you've got your numbers that you're trying to beat the last year's numbers. And so you're just squeezing as hard as you can year in, year after year after year after year. Just gradually, you get to the point where you're doing completely absurd things. And you have been doing completely absurd things like this for years, and people have gotten used to it or whatever, until it finally reaches a breaking point like this. When you have a strong job market, and when you have people who are being told that they're essential, but aren't important enough to get time off when they're sick, eventually the powder keg's going to blow.
And with the powder keg blowing, especially right now, I think this is where we can segue nicely into the broader end of this whole topic. That's going to be, we're looking at this uncertainty right now, right? There's this whole economic uncertainty. We're hearing the term recession. We're hearing about more layoffs happening. This would have sort of accelerated some of that. You know, maybe it would have been furloughs or what have you, but...
You know what? 2 days ago, we were planning this episode to be like, okay, like the S just hit the fan with the railroad strike. Like, it seemed like it was a done deal. I mean, that's a high level of uncertainty to be living with.
Yes. And that whole thing, you know, are we in a recession? And it's really weird because we're having these really, it's just interesting economic times right now, right? And I think this has been the case for us for some time, is that we're going through these really interesting economic situations that challenge the common thought of what we think about what a recession is or what might be the...
I don't even want to hear that word anymore. Like, it's just the semantic nonsense. The economy is challenging in some significant ways. Like, that's all that matters. Inflation is high. Gas just went down like a huge amount, and yet overall inflation still basically stayed the same last month. I mean, there's bright spots and there's challenges, as always. Just lately, the challenges have been quite fascinating challenges. like you said.
They're fascinating, especially when we're looking at two jobs for every one unemployed person mm-hmm. available still. Mm-hmm. And we're still sitting around this unemployment rate that's sort of record mm-hmm. lows, which again, we're getting these confusing signals. And that's not to say that we're not going to reset a little bit or there isn't a recession looming, but certainly a railroad strike would have had a pretty profound impact in a lot of these, I would almost say, foundational necessities with food and so on. We already have a car, an issue with getting new cars out as it is.
Would have been a golden era for truck drivers.
If there were enough of those, we're short on those too.
Right. They got their whole other set of labor management issues going on already.
And that's been a big mm-hmm. thing is that, you know, the truck drivers are short on drivers and companies are scrambling to try to.
Although they're not, they have enough people who are qualified to drive. They just keep treating them like crap. So people are like, no, I don't want to do that job anymore.
Yep. Another example of, but that's so fragmented, it's hard to get the unions there too. At least for those like long haul truckers. No, you're right. I mean, I know there's tracker unions and such, but it's much harder when you have so much fragmentation in that.
Yeah, a lot of them are, one man operations.
Like, yeah. Or they're small, like three or five drivers, this kind of thing. So I look at this and you go, okay, so what's going on and what do we deal with? And it's just a really, really chaotic time. And this led the Harvard Business Review to release a newsletter this just recently, like just a couple of days ago, that was talking about, the Great Apprehension. And the whole idea of the Great Apprehension is because we're starting to see all these things going on. We're hearing more layoffs, but then we're also hearing about these like rail strikes and all these things. That starts creating anxiety for people, right? Because at the end of the day, it's about the unknown.
Yeah.
It's the unknown. We have no idea like what's happening. And we're not getting good answers because this person over here is saying X, this mm-hmm. person over here is saying Y, this person over here is saying Z. And it's just, they're all kind of in it for their own sort of talking points. And at the end of the day, let's just put it this way. Most of them are wrong anyway.
Right.
There's very few who are ever right about any of this stuff. But that's what we do, though. That's what we do is we try to latch onto something that gives us some sort of concrete certainty,
right.
Even if it's wrong.
Even if we sort of suspect it might be wrong, it's something to latch on.
Yes, exactly. And so we latch onto that. And so we have this whole thing about the Great Apprehension, and that's what's going on. And what's really interesting in this situation is that apparently what happens to employees is that they go in typically two broad directions. Either they try to work harder and kick up their efforts to, quote, prove their worth, while another faction of people will pull back as though they've already been cut.
Yep.
So we've got this divergence, right? On the one hand, it's people are working harder, and it kind of reminds me of hustle culture and sort of that reinforcement of that. Whereas on the other end, it's like, oh, I'm quiet quitting now because I feel like I'm going to get laid. I mean, who knows? I mean, I don't know. It's just this whole sort of chaos going on. And at the end of the day, I really do think this is just about self-preservation. What's my coping mechanism and how do I cope? Some people will cope by, all right, I'm just going to accept the inevitable. But it might not even be the inevitable.
And I'm going to skip to the punchline here is that, you know, if you're coping like that in the face of uncertainty, you're doing it wrong. If you have structure your life in such a way to the extent that you can, that you've got a built-in buffer for whatever the future may bring. Because, you know, we don't always get these like threats telegraphed the way they are right now. You know, sometimes 9/11 or COVID just happens and all of a sudden things just change from one day to the next. We very rarely get any kind of ramp up time to prepare for things like this. So to the extent we call it conservation of resources theory in academia, but to the extent that you've got a buffer of quote unquote resources, which means money and financial resources, but you know, also social support in place and
keeping that resume up to date.
Keep your resume up to date. Yeah. So like
just little
bad thing, something, bam, you wake up one day and it's not a good day. You're like, all right, well, I've already got a polish up resume. I've already got, you know, connections with these other employers. I've got a 6 months emergency fund saved up. It sucks, but it's not so bad. Like that makes, you know, the apprehension is still there, but it keeps it from becoming the great panic. Yes.
And I think that's key too. And if you're in a situation where you're living paycheck to paycheck, I would almost be willing to bet that in your city that you're closest to or that you're in, there are probably resources provided by the city or even your state that will help you with figuring out how you can manage your finances a little bit more. They provide you like free sort of financial planning to at least help you start putting a little bit aside. I mean, I'm not even talking about putting in and making 6 months of emergency fund like out the gate. I'm just saying, hey, start disappearing $10 into an offsite savings account if that's all you can do, and have it do it from the day your paycheck goes in, every paycheck, so you don't even think about it, and have it be offsite versus in your typical standard bank account where you see it.
I did that with $50 when I started working at University of New Hampshire. Automatically just went to some other savings account and never saw it in the paycheck. And I never really gave it much thought until like 5 years had gone by. And I wonder how much I have in that account now. Yeah, it was like $6,000. I was like, oh my God, I had no idea. I've got this like, I mean, I knew it was there. I didn't know how much it was.
But you never thought about it, yeah.
And that's small amounts of money, you know, they add up. The best, what's that saying? Like the best time to start doing this was 5 years ago. The second best time is today.
Yep. It just starts small. It's just a great thing to do. And over time, you will find that that will give you some security, especially as you start figuring out other things too. But at the end of the day, that's just one piece. And like I said, keeping your resume up to date is an important factor. If you're only doing a resume, I sometimes recommend people to keep what we would call a curriculum vitae, which is just keep track of all the things, like whatever you're getting like acknowledged for at work, like an award, or if you're doing something new that you hadn't done before, you're getting a new training, document all that stuff.
Good idea.
So you can tailor your resume for a job. You know, you don't want to give them the CV, but this way you can at least pull the pieces out. Cause I don't know about you guys, but I am hugely forgetful about some of the things that I've even done in terms of like, I'll remember the outcomes from it or whatever I've learned, but I don't remember actually having done it. It's just like, oh, it's in my brain now.
There's at least once my annual review for, you know, we submit like a summary of all the stuff we did. It's like, yeah, I think this is everything. And I guess it was my department chair. It's like, didn't you do like, there's some major, huge thing. Like, didn't you do that big freaking thing? Like, oh yeah, yeah. I'll put that in there. Like just completely. Yeah.
Just, yeah.
You got to keep it all in a running catalog of some sort.
Exactly. And so that's the stuff that's critical, right? That's the stuff that we don't think about. And you know, I don't know. It's just so funny because
even coaching your kids' little league team, you know, like all that stuff that you do that's of value to someone else.
And that way you can, again, tailor your resume to the job that you might be applying to in the event this happens. Now, there's this HBR article that deals with layoff anxiety. And one of the things it says is to, quote, examine what evidence you have that points to the likelihood of a layoff and whether or not you will be impacted. So these are some of the things that they had put in there for cues to look out for in the event you are starting to get concerned about potentially being laid off. First is, has your manager asked you to implement cost-saving measures? I mean, that's fair.
Yep.
The second one is, has the company instituted a hiring freeze? Are sales consistently down? And by that, you know, thinking quarter over quarter. So how did we do the quarter before? How are we doing that quarter before that? Where we are now? Are those down? Obviously, if sales go down, that means that there's going to potentially be some budgetary issues coming up. But that doesn't always indicate layoff, right? I mean, we want to kind of think about the evidence as a whole. Is your workload lighter than usual? That's an interesting one to me. It's like, hey, is your workload lighter? Is that because they're now starting to take that and assign it to a different department, to a different org? Or are they starting to shave that part of the business away in some capacity? Outsource it? Who knows, right? And are you being pushed out of meetings you previously participated in? Now, I think that to me is like the biggest red flag that I'm about to be out.
Next to like your login password stops working. That's probably the
That one's the evidence that you're going out that day. You just haven't been told
yet. Probably already happened to you.
Well, and you know, even interestingly too, I have a former student of mine who works at Ernst & Young. And just recently, Ernst & Young announced that they're doing the split, right? They're splitting their auditing from their consulting businesses. And interestingly enough, they all heard through the press about the split before they even, and he's on the consulting side. So I thought that was very interesting because I sent it to him. I was like, you probably know this. He's like, yeah, they got on and they just told us that they were doing it, but didn't give us any information. We're getting more through the media right now. So just to give everybody insights, like, hey, the companies are bad at communicating. And
social media is really good at communicating.
And really good at communicating negative stuff too. Yeah. But, you know, it made me continue to think about this idea of a lot of the stress comes from different things, right? One is the idea of the rumor mill and gossip.
Oh my God, yeah.
And really, it's about rumors turning into gossip, whatever. So that's one avenue.
I'm thinking that guy in Office Space that was like every day, like anything anyone did, he's like, that's it, we're all getting fired.
Yes. So I came across this article that was published in Culture and Organization in 2021 by Liff and Wickstrom. And I just briefly want to touch on this because this got me thinking about the rumors. And in their world, they define basically that a rumor that's pretty much unchecked turns into gossip. And then gossip is what turns things, which I thought was interesting in its own right, because I always kind of conflate the two. Right. I always think rumors and gossip. So I thought that was an interesting progression in there. But they basically said that rumors were a key source of information for managers. Now, thinking about that, it's not that there was key source of information for them to, you know, they're finding out through the rumors. It's more along the lines of it's a key source of information to understand what their people are not getting for information in a sense, right? You know, in the absence of information, people are going to fill it in with stories. Managers trust in informal information created. Managers trust in informal information created trust among staff members in their manager's abilities. So basically the manager treating it like it's a real thing. Because to them, they're perceiving it as real.
Right.
These rumors are filling in.
Perception is reality until it's proven otherwise.
Otherwise, right. Yeah. And so that helps increase the manager's trust. So they're right there. It's like, listen to your people, right? Mindful communication thing. And then negative rumors can turn to gossip when not recognized and handled competently. So basically, if you know,
but say that
these rumors are going on as a manager, you have to go and stifle them in some way. Now, obviously that's going to require you to one, acknowledge that rumor exists. And then two, make sure that you're providing information that's got some level of concrete aspect to it. Now you might as a manager be just as clueless as everybody else. And that's not also,
but don't let people think you know more than you really know.
Yeah. Right. But at least you're acknowledging that this is a thing and you're like, hey, I'm going to do something about it, right? I'm going to try to find out. That's your job, right?
And you know, there's been, we're all kind of conditioned into this, like this mindset from all the way to the top. You see it with the government all the time. It drives me nuts. Like, well, we said this because we didn't want to cause an overreaction, a panic. Like we're talking about adults here, all right? Like you can be straight. And I think really the debate has become moot at this point because like your example, the Ernst & Young example kind of indicates the information is going to get out. Do you want to be the one delivering the information to your people or do you want to let Twitter do it for you?
Don't let Twitter do it for you. So there's those things. Now, here's some additional things. One, going back to the HBR sort of those questions, it says that if the answer is no to those, then you're probably of low risk. If you find that you still are having these thoughts, it says to try, quote, mindful breathing. It says, imagine letting go of the unhelpful thoughts on your out breath. Now, I would say Nixon is also a great move. We've talked about Nixon trying to just clear your mind and just focus in on something mundane.
Right? Yep. Yep. Yeah. And let your mind rest. Like anxiety and worry, it's tiring to your brain. You know, just like focus on the faucet dripping or whatever for 5 minutes, whatever. You'd be surprised. But, you know, those working exercises, they sound sort of cliche and silly, but damned if they don't work, you know?
It's the intentionality. And that's why it works. Yeah. It's the intentionality. It's you making an intentional action.
Yeah, good point.
That makes your brain go, okay, I'm doing an active thing to try to do against it. Because if you just try to go, I'm just going to ignore it. And you just try to do other things like keep yourself busy. You're not being active towards trying to go, okay, I'm at a lower.
And your brain is not ignoring it. Like there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on that you're not conscious of that's still happening.
Right.
Unless you take control.
Now, they also in this HBR article too, we've covered this one a little bit, but I thought there's some good extra pieces to this. It says, are your projects high value? Is your work revenue generating? Are you assigned to initiatives that senior leadership considers important? If not, they recommend speaking to your boss about modifying your workload, and which I think is interesting.
Touchy in times of potential layoffs, but yeah. Yep.
And then this is one that I really do. It basically says, work on developing your network with internal stakeholders and keep your ear to the ground about news of reorganizations or restructurings. So basically it's telling you to go out and network internally. Listen
to the rumor mill, basically.
Yeah. In essence. Yes. And says, likewise, don't wait to begin re-engaging your network. Reconnect with old colleagues and managers. Join an industry group or trade association. You'll feel calmer about possible change if you have supportive people in your corner.
That's what I was trying to get at with the social support aspect of your coping resources. Yeah.
Yes. And that's a perfect aspect of it, and some other examples for. And here's what we were just saying. Set aside a few hours to make sure your resume, portfolio, and LinkedIn profile are up to date. So as it goes through, let's say instead of spending some time on social media, you have some intentionality about preparing yourself in the event of a layoff. And so some things you can do about looking at improving your LinkedIn, for example, is go see what some others have done for their LinkedIn profiles and imitate some good actions there, right? Obviously using your information, but do something like that.
If you're in the type of job where LinkedIn profiles are relevant.
Yeah. And I think, for job searches too, it's becoming ever more.
A surprising amount are. Yeah. Yep.
So even if the layoff, so here it says basically, even if the layoff doesn't happen, you'll be better positioned to have to make a move if you ever have to make that move, right? Like you'll be able. Mm-hmm. Now, exactly. This one is interesting to me because this one, I guess I do this, and I think we all do to some extent, but it's deploy defensive pessimism.
I'm intrigued.
Yes. So it says opening, make worry work to your advantage by taking your fear out of its extreme. Ask yourself, what would you do if you were laid off? What are the next steps that you would take? Walk through your plan in detail. Anticipate how you deal with obstacles such as your finances, healthcare, and finding a new job. Now, see, this one I find is kind of what strategic management's about. Right?
Yeah.
It's that we're going to create a short-term plan, but thinking about the big picture. So you think about where you see your life being as far out as you can see it, right? What would you like out of life? And go, okay, well, that's that. You have to just start taking little baby steps to get there over time, right? It's an accrual of time. Mm-hmm. But what do I need to do now to ensure that I still keep that as my long-term objective as being possible still, right? As making sure that I can still get there. And I think the exercise just simply of planning out every detail, if you were to have to go home with no job and start mapping out what it is that your next steps would be. Mm-hmm. It's brilliant. I mean, it means that now you have a plan, you've thought through it. And it's just like we tell, entrepreneurs that create a business plan. It's those same kind of things, is you're mapping out certain things to give yourself something that takes away uncertainty.
Right.
And that's what's cool about that. And they call it defensive pessimism.
I've never thought of describing it that way, but it works. I like it.
And basically, it says that research shows that mentally rehearsing your response to worst case scenarios helps harness anxiety instead of allowing it to harm you, which I think is fascinating. Yeah. I mean, that's one that I've never really thought about. It's a new thing to come across. And again, this is why you listen to the Busyness Paradox, because
that's right.
You get to find out all sorts of new fun stuff out there and hopefully help you cope a little bit more with this. Something else here, it's like rally your resilience. This deals with things like thinking about the three hardest challenges you've overcome.
And that helps, this builds resilience. Like,
right.
If you have these challenges, know that you're building resilience for the future too. I mean, if you're listening to the show, you survived COVID. If you're old enough, you survived 9/11. You've made it through stuff before.
Yes, exactly. And using that to say, hey, I've always bounced back. And I mean, what that does is shows that you have this resilience and things work out. I mean, it's really easy to get doom and gloom. And I think social media has a tendency to, and it's not just social media. I think the news these days has the tendency to do that. I mean,
you're watching cable news, you're poisoning your mind.
Yeah. I mean, even I have struggled sometimes with the news and trying to fight that, like, my gosh, it's all bad. It's all bad. It's all bad. Mm-hmm. It's like, what are we doing? You know,
it can't be all
it
that.
It can't be.
Like, I mean, there's a lot of bad, but there's got to be good stuff.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead or whatever.
Yeah. So. And I run into this so much and and it's just trying to sometimes ignore it, avoid it, stay away from it for a little bit, focusing on what you can control, which is in your sphere of, you know, trying to understand where you are specifically. Ignore the external unnecessary annoyances.
We cut the cable years ago. Like, we don't have TV really. So I haven't watched or been in the vicinity of TV news, cable news in 5-6 years. It makes you noticeably happier. I mean, it's not that there aren't bad things happening in the world, but they're not top of your mind all the time. Those things aren't going to, you're not going to fix anything by being constantly reminded about all the problems in the world. So give yourself a break. Like you said, work on what you can control personally.
That's the thing, right? Work on what you can control and really recognize that there's a lot of externalities that it might be doom and gloom, but you got to go that at the end of the day, I have nothing I can do about that. Let me just focus in on what I have the immediate coverage to deal with. And that's things like, you know, improving your connection with your spouse potentially, or your significant other, or your family, or not even improving that, just making sure that you have that there and leverage that. Yeah. A friend, it doesn't matter. A pet.
Yeah. Make sure you have one, you know, if you're lonely and single, work on that. Put some other priorities on the side and, you know.
Well, and that's what this next thing says, is it says invest in self-complexity. And I think that's exactly what you're saying, right? Invest in things, because it says that there was a study in the Frontiers of Psychology where the researchers found that people who reduce themselves to one attribute, so I'm just reading this right off of here, their job, if they reduce themselves to just their job, they felt dehumanized, like nothing more than a machine or a tool, and had higher levels of disengagement, depression, and burnout. So what the self-complexity idea is to reflect the number and diversity of attributes that make up the meaningful aspects of who you are. And so therefore, it's about diversifying your sense of self. And, you know, I just personally, I find that fascinating already in itself, right? It's just like that aspect. So think about things like your personal life, or I think you mentioned it's like if you're coaching a little league team, you know, just whatever. It's like put time into your hobbies, spirituality, health, you know, go start exercising or building a Lego or hitting a golf ball, something, right? Just start adding things to increase your identity.
You can see what's on my finger right now.
Paul's got a yo-yo for those who.
I got into yo-yoing during the pandemic. My daughter brought home a yo-yo from the little toy box at the dentist one day, and I started playing with it. And, you know, there are times, like, especially when you're trying to think through something challenging or just distract yourself or whatever, these little hobbies that you might have where, you know, you can practice at some trick and get better at it and have, like, that instant feedback, instant sort of dopamine gratification thing from something that's actually healthy and not, like, doom scrolling on Twitter. Yeah, it sounds ridiculous and silly, but it's beneficial.
It really is. So I think those are some really interesting things to consider. Again, that whole idea of take constructive action. So basically work on your resume, work on developing your network and making new connections or reconnecting with others that you've worked with in the past, what have you, joining a trade association, blah, blah, blah. Defensive pessimism, where you map out a plan of action for what you would do if you were laid off. Rally your resilience. So work on your resiliency by sort of thinking about those times you went through things. As Paul said, the pandemic is a great one. You made it through the pandemic. In this example here, one of us was like, this person didn't get into their top choice of college and that bothered them. Another one talked about going through a divorce and it's like, hey, what do those things do? It's like, hey, I got through them and I continued to move forward. And those are the things, it's about moving forward, right?
It's the only way you can go, so you may as well make it work.
Yeah. Right, make it work. And then invest in that self-complexity. So invest in that, your identity, right? Don't make it just about your work. Find other things that define who you are.
Make yourself interesting, I've heard it said before.
Don't deal with people who are trying to tell you that you can't go to the doctor and they try to make you like feel bad about it or get fired. That's your health is important. Bottom line.
And you know, all these people striking are showing that we've kind of largely been conditioned to believe that we're at the mercy of all these economic fluctuations and the decisions made by our higher ups and management and political leaders and whatnot. And, you know, all these hundreds of thousands of people striking, threatening to strike, sometimes against the wishes of their union, you know, leaders or against the law sometimes. And they're just saying, no, like, we're people too. Like, we get a say in this. So can you.
And that's it, right? And I think this all ties back. This is why we've been seeing things like the quote unquote great resignation. We're seeing things like quiet quitting. I think all those tie into sort of what we're seeing here too, is these opportunities.
Common theme.
Yeah. There's a lot of this going on right now. And I think one of the things the pandemic taught us is that we could certainly have a little bit more freedom or flexibility in the work environment for our people today. The technology affords it. Everything is there. All the pieces are there. If you're a manager, it's time to figure out ways to make this work for your people. And if you're not going to be laying people off, make sure that you're pretty clear about that.
Yeah. Don't use panic as a motivational, you know, tool. Like, keep them guessing. So they'll be more motivated to work hard. Like, no, that is going to backfire on you.
Yes. So if you're one of those people who's feeling anxious about layoffs or you're anxious about the economy, there are things, there's actions that you can do. We've laid it out. We're going to share the link to this HBR article if you can get access to it. If not, this is one of those things, try to find it, get it from somebody, but we'll provide the link.
By any means necessary.
Yes. But you know, that's a good aspect of it there. Or, you know, just take what we've said and just try to find more information on those. If you have to buy the article directly from HBR because they're not giving it to you, it's like $9, but you know.
Yeah, use your Google fool. Yeah. Sure you can find it.
Yeah, use those big headers, right? Like talking about like building your resiliency, that kind of stuff. But broadly, it's about trying to move forward. And at the end of the day, honestly, if you're unhappy at your work and you're worried about it, this is the best time to now put yourself in a position to do better for yourself.
You will wish you did 5 years from now.
Yes.
Or you can be glad that you did 5 years from now. Your choice.
And I'll just say it. I believe in you. I do. And if you're a manager and your company is struggling a little bit, reach out to Paul and I. We'll help you out.
If we can, we certainly will.
I don't know. What do you got anything else on this?
No, I think.
Oh, I will. I'm going to do this on your behalf. The other day, Paul and I were prepping on what we wanted to do for this episode, and he had made a comment about automating the good habits. Automate the good habits.
I had no idea where you were going with that. Yeah. That's right. Automate the good habits, not the bad ones.
For example,
like automatic savings.
The automatic savings. Just set it up where like the day your paycheck comes in, $10 goes out or 50, whatever you think you can afford to do. If it's a dollar, do a dollar. I don't really care. Make sure that you're putting money into your 401k, you know, that's up to the match that your company does if you have that. If you're not doing that, you should slap yourself in the head and go, I got to do that now because you're giving up free money. You're giving up part of your benefits package.
And I want to hear like, I can't because, you know, my car payment and stuff, like, no. I guess pull a Dave Ramsey if you have to. Like, sell your car, buy a bicycle with a broken tire. Like,
I don't go.
Your future self will thank you very much.
I won't go full Dave Ramsey, but yeah, I mean, I would say certainly try to seek out one of those financial programs provided by your city, your state, that's there to help people with their financial management. Even go to your like local college, your university, or even if you're an alumni of a university or a college, go to them. They probably have somebody you can talk to. Use our resources. Why not?
Honestly, the personal finance subreddit on reddit.com, has lots and lots of good advice. Yeah. Wall Street Bets, you know.
Don't do that.
Take with a grain of salt.
But personal.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. They're funny. But get your house in order before you start.
Right. And again.
Doing what they're doing.
Automate. This is a good statement by Paul. It's automate the good habits. So automate the good habits. Automate things like that. Automate making yourself update your resume every, you know, month.
Yeah.
Use your...
Have it just pop up on the last day of the month.
Yeah. Use your calendar, use your reminders app, whatever it is. I mean, all the phones these days have these little things and stick to it. Just start automating the good pieces. So I, like, for example, I now have gotten better about when I've done something for work, I add it to my Vita like that day. Or if I know I've got something coming up, even before I do it, I'll go ahead and put it on. Like teaching this particular class in the fall, I already had it on there before I even taught it because I knew it was going to happen. You know, just go ahead and just get in the habit of doing it as it happens.
Mm-hmm. I've not been good about doing that myself, but yeah.
It's structure. Remember, the last year was our structure. So that's part of the structure. That's the automate the good habits. Anyway.
So that's funny. A year ago, we would have been like, structure. Now we're basically saying the same logic. It just never occurred to me. The overlap. Yeah.
It's
we're still talking about structure because it kicks ass.
And it's all about reducing that busyness and getting yourself out of just that funk that is only about my job or blah, blah, blah. Find yourself.
So you're spinning your wheels trying to, you know, keep your job, get your bills just barely paid, and it's no fun.
And if you're a manager, here's something you can do. If you've got an employee who seems to identify pretty much that all they have is work, try to find what they like and send them away for a day and have them go do it. Hey, be like, hey, man, go do this.
I mean, not even necessarily in your role as a manager, but as a role in your role as like friend.
Coworker, colleague, friend.
A coworker. Like, is you're in a position that you see things that other people don't just because, you know, you've got a higher level position. You might be aware that, you know, someone could use a nudge in a more healthy life direction.
Right. And it seems sort of trivial, but trust me, it's not.
Yeah, it's not.
Make sure that, you know, you don't have to get to know your if you're a manager, you don't have to get to know your people on a super personal level, but at least you want to know the basics of what they enjoy doing outside of work. If they're saying that there's nothing or it's something that's super isolating, maybe encourage them to do something that in some way, right? If it is gaming, it's like, you know, maybe they're finding that outlet in gaming. Or if it's building Lego, there are adult Lego organizations out there. I just, you know, it's the 8-Falls, adult fans of Lego. If it's yo-yoing, there are yo-yoing groups out there.
If
it's ping pong, table tennis, literally, we call ping pong. Yeah. Table tennis actually has associations and clubs. Yeah. Everywhere. I had no idea. There's something for everybody.
No. There really is.
Nobody's alone. That's the one thing I've learned. Nobody's alone on anything.
No one has to be alone.
Right.
And you know, like this might sound like feel good silliness, but not to bring it to a dark place, but you know, for these incidents of workplace violence, near as we can tell, almost all of them can be prevented simply by a manager just saying, hey, you know, you doing all right? You know, how's life? Just letting people know that they're not alone so they feel less isolated and they have some kind of connection. Like that's perhaps the one common thread in so many of these, you know, the workplace shootings and everything that we happen on the 1st and 15th of every month in the U.S. It's just lack of personal connection and psychological isolation. So
yeah, it's so true. So just to sum it up again real quick, separate fact from fiction. That's asking the questions of like, has your manager asked you to implement cost-saving measures? Has the company instituted a hiring freeze? Are the sales consistently down? Workload lighter than usual? Take constructive action. So work on your network.
Email password's not working.
Yeah. Password's not working. Take constructive action. Work on your LinkedIn, your resume, your portfolio, networking with old bosses or with others. You know, put your ear to ground. Deploy defensive pessimism. Plan out in the event you were to be laid off, like what you would do. Rally your resilience. So think about the things you've managed to get through and realize that ultimately, I think, you know, you got through them. Might have stunk and it might have been painful or whatever, but, you know that you can get through it and just know that you're strong enough to do that. And then invest in self-complexity. So don't just be only about your job. Again, as Paul was saying, if you just ask somebody how they're doing, it can go a long way. Because if they only identify about their job or with their job as their only thing, then you go in there. You
take that away.
Disengagement, depression, and burnout. And if you take that away, that can, in some cases, lead to violence. So let's just it's treat people like people, right? I mean, that's, as Kurt Tofert said, Kurt Tofert said on our interview a while back, he said, lead people, manage things, right? So let's go with that.
Go with that. Well said. Good summary, Frank.
I'm out. I'm going on strike.
Resume strike.
Good day.
Good day.
The Busyness Paradox is distributed by Paul Harvey and Frank Butler. Our theme music is adapted from It's Business Time by Jermaine Clements and Brett McKenzie. Our production manager is Justin One Take. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we'd love to hear from you. Please send any questions, comments, or ideas for future episode topics to input@busynessparadox.com or find us on Twitter. Also, be sure to visit our website, busynessparadox.com, to read our blog posts and for links to the articles and other resources mentioned in today's show. Finally, please take a moment to rate and follow or subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, or, I don't know, wherever the heck you get your podcasts.